Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 671, June 2023.
Welcome back to The Incomparable. I'm guest host Lex Friedman because Jason Snell foolishly let me have the reins. And today, as you know from the title, we're talking about Barry. When I first approached Jason and said, hey, the Mothership hasn't done an episode about Barry. Should we? Jason's response was, it's a little off format. A little off format. But I'd allow it. So with that blessing, here we are. I'm joined by not one, but two Brians. First, you just heard them laugh. It's Brian Hamilton. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Did both of you bring a monologue?
We're going to walk and talk. I'm also joined by another Brian, my co-host on Sorkinated, Brian Warren. Hi, Brian.
Hey, everybody. I kind of wonder if I want to be Noho Hank, but I'm afraid I'm the Cousineau of this operation.
Oh, man. That's tough. I don't know who's who. But so I will say, if you have a streaming series and you were previously a star on SNL, I'm going to give it a shot. That's basically how it goes with me. It's why I knew that I was going to try out Ted Lasso, and that worked out well. And it's why I knew I was going to try out Barry, because I was intrigued by Bill Hader, who I think is really talented, even before I ever saw Barry. But let's start at the beginning. What motivated you both to decide to give Barry a shot in the first place?
I got to say, I had a little bit of a crush on Bill Hader from the beginning, just because I think this person is freaking funny. And so I was like, well, even just a regular interview with him or any kind of clip that rolls by on YouTube or something, I will watch and start giggling. And so I was like, well, sure, I'm in. I'm sure I will just giggle with delight about this. Turns out a little bit different than that, but I was in.
Oh, that'll be a key topic, I think. And Brian Hamilton?
I loved Bill Hader for a very, very long time from SNL, from other Lonely Island movies. And I think that when Barry, well, first Skeleton Twins came out, which was Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig doing this devastatingly beautiful story about two siblings going through some really hard times. I saw that in, 2014 when that came out, and I was blown away by how great Bill Hader was in a serious role. And so, of course, I tried out Barry when it first came out. I was sold. I marathoned the entire first season in one day. And then the finale of the first season happened, and I realized, you know, this is great. I'll be thinking about this for a long time. And then season two came out, and I didn't watch it because I realized, you know, this is not going to be resolved for a very long time. I don't think I'm in a place where I can be left on a cliffhanger this long. And so I started from season one, episode one, again, the week of the season four finale. And here I am now marathoning the entire series in 2 weeks?
We appreciate your service.
Wow. That's pretty impressive. So, I went in part delighted by the premise. And I guess I think you probably, dear listener, came into this episode assuming such, but the entire Barry series has concluded on HBO or on Max. And the spoiler horn sounds for all further discussion, I guess, right? But I went into the show and I thought that the log line, such as it was, right? If, you know, we've got a hitman who is, I guess, going to be drawn to acting. And Henry Winkler's going to be in it. Like, of course I was going to watch this show. And I think we've all alluded to this already, but the show really goes on a journey from being an explicit comedy to being something, I don't even know what it is, but not a comedy. A dark something that I don't think season four is a comedy. I think season four is still funny. And sometimes I think it's very funny. But it's not exactly a comedy, right? It's something else.
This bending of genres is so, it does make it really hard show to recommend to people. I've tried recommending it to people and I can't put together a log line that makes really sense as far as like why I really like it. I have to keep leaning back on like, well, if you like Bill Hader, he's extremely talented and he shows a lot more depth than you think. But recommending to people that it's a dark comedy just isn't quite enough.
I think the biggest parallel between this and another show in terms of difficult to recommend is Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
Equally incredible shows that if you are signing up for the several season run, you have to be prepared for emotional turmoil that few other shows reach those heights for. And so I feel very complicatedly about, like, God, I love this show. And it's really difficult to recommend unless you know somebody can not handle it, but like be there for the journey and be there for the ride, especially if while you're watching as it was airing, every single episode ends on a cliffhanger.
And I think it's got even more parallels with those two shows you referenced, because you can, especially with Breaking Bad, there's a trick being played on you from very early on that you're not supposed to be rooting for the guy you're rooting for, right?
Yeah.
And like, if you finish Breaking Bad and you're still rooting for Walt, you have misunderstood Breaking Bad. And I don't think you can root for Barry either. I mean, I say that as if I wasn't 100% confident. I am 100% confident. You cannot be rooting for Barry. Barry is bad. Barry is a bad person. Some of that is maybe not his own fault, but he is a bad person. And I think that's tricky too. I want to go into all the main characters because there's so many great ones, but the other piece of this show, besides being genre bending, is that it also really consistently messes with reality, where I still don't know what really happened in some times, right? Like, Sally goes on a real journey in season 4 where she is clearly hallucinating in real time. And I don't know what really does happen and doesn't happen. Like, at one point there's an intruder in the home, or maybe there isn't, but like the entire house seems to move, but we never see any of those intruders. She keeps seeing the guy she shot as various other people. He's bleeding from his eyeball as a police officer near the end of the series. Like, I don't know what's really happening to her. And then there's, I think it's season 3. I was trying to find this earlier and I couldn't, but I think it's season 3 where Barry has a Matrix-esque fight with a young girl. Do you know the episode I'm referring to?
I totally remember this one. Yes.
Where it seemed like it was in Supernatural, right? She was not human. She was not behaving like a human, but it's never acknowledged that it is impossible for this. I mean, Barry kind of is like, what the hell is going on? But they never explain how it's happening. And so there's, beyond being like also thriller and horror and dark and comedy, it's also something else. I wouldn't say it's not sci-fi exactly, but it is surreal in ways that very few shows based in reality are.
Yeah, they never did this in Better Call Saul or Breaking Bad, as far as I remember.
Very grounded in reality.
Yeah. That dreamlike quality just endears me to it even more, though. I remember that scene when he's battling that childlike creature, I guess. And she's like on all fours and walking like spider-like around the room. And I think I had a giant smile on my face because I'm like, what are they doing to me right now? But yeah. I was in.
So let's first, I also, before we go deeper in the characters, I guess I also want to acknowledge that Bill Hader, besides being great on this show and a great writer on this show, is a superb director on this show. One of those people who, and Brian Warren and I have gone through a season of getting increasingly surprised that Aaron Sorkin knows how to direct movies, but Bill Hader is directing TV shows, which he obviously hadn't done prior, really, and kills it. Like, when I was in the opening credits, if you saw that the episode was going to be directed by Bill Hader, I knew it was going to be one of the better ones, because he really, he really crushed it at that. And I was very impressed by his ability on that front.
There's something about the SNL alum world right now that really kind of bends my brain. So Succession also just ended, and it was produced by Will Ferrell and Adam McKay. And Barry took a heel turn into, you know, more serious acting and television creation since working with SNL, since working with Lonely Island. And I think that there's something really special about the fact that HBO scooped up and made deals with those two groups of people in particular to make very dramatic and sometimes difficult to watch shows that are also deeply subversively funny. And I'm extremely sad that both shows are over, and I really hope that trend continues, if not at HBO or Max, then somewhere else. But this, Barry, seems like the ultimate proof that this model of let's trust somebody who is an industry veteran works.
And I think even on podcasts like Fly on the Wall with Dana Carvey and David Spade, they've talked about how SNL cast members have to go through such a boot camp of doing all the things and seeing so much happen so quickly and efficiently. And, you know, you end up being the director of every sketch that you author and such, that they get a whole lot of on the job training. So it's working. It's working. And last thing before we do start diving in a little bit more into plot and into characters, I was really intrigued by the fact that the show's title card evolved over the seasons, where if there was a fifth or sixth season, at some point it would just be a red blob. Like, it started out and there was what I would call kerning, maybe. And by season four, it was like a real mush of those letters pushed close together.
I've never noticed that.
It's, I was actually trying to find earlier today a website that breaks down all those different title cards, and I don't see one. But it really did start out where each letter was kind of unique, and by the fourth season it was really mushed together, and I to me it just worked. I didn't give it too much thought, but like, things are closing in or things are getting increasingly claustrophobic or something. But I did feel like every aspect of the show was working for the show. Like, you'd sometimes still have audio at the end credits when there's nothing left on the screen. And like, shots were thoughtful and moments were thoughtful and the music was thoughtful. And I thought, hey, even the title card is thoughtful. I don't know. But so do you have, if we were doing a Barry character draft, would you have to spot everyone in NoHo, Hank? Like, who are your favorite characters?
Oh gosh. Yeah. I would say NoHo, Hank. I mean, it's tough because I feel like Henry Winkler totally chews up every scene that he's in, and you get these great stuff about him off camera, or I hear these great interviews about him. And I think Barry mentions it, or Bill Hader mentions that Kusnow would bring Bundt cakes to set, and he just couldn't stop talking about the cakes. So, man, I don't know. I find myself very endeared to him, but NoHo Hank, I feel like this Anthony Carrigan, he's like this alien from outer space. He is incredibly funny, and he's like one of the first people who was just like so silly on the set that I'd have to pick him.
NoHo Hank absolutely stole the show. For me, I think my two favorite actors on the show that are not part of the like main cast are the two Good Place alums. We have Kirby Howell-Baptiste, who plays Sasha in Cousteau's acting class, and oh my gosh, her bit about seeing a horse in London, I still laugh about it every single time I think about it. And then Darcy Carden, who played Janet in Good Place, who I love dearly, and I just keep calling her Janet whenever I watch this show. I think she did an incredible job taking something as silly as the role she was given and turning it into something that was genuinely it gave her this arc that most main characters on a lot of shows would be lucky to get as an actor, and she got one as like, well, I don't know, second or third tier of actor in the show, to the point where she's mostly not in season four. I thought she was incredible and perfect at what she was given.
I can't disagree with any of that. What I find especially fascinating about NoHo Hank, the character, and about Anthony Carrigan's portrayal, and I wasn't really familiar with Anthony prior. This is like my defining role for him. But that's a character that, as you were saying, he's very silly. And again, a character kind of based in his own reality and really given some of the most farcical stuff. But he really grounds it. Like, it's still, he's basically never anything but hilarious on the show, but he comes at it from a place of like, he fully embodies the character, and it's never winking, and it's never, the character is silly, but the performance is never silly, if that makes sense. And I really felt like if there were actors I could take acting lessons from in the show, coincidentally enough, given that's what Henry does, Gene, but that he really, It felt to me like a masterclass. Like, in part, we know Bill Hader so well that you see, hey, there's Bill Hader acting. I feel the same way about Stephen Root. Hey, there's Stephen Root as a character. And I think Stephen Root does a great job of being a truly hateable character on this show. But, like, man, Anthony Carrigan was so good in that role. And just, I don't know. Any moments that he wasn't on screen felt like slightly wasted moments of Barry to me.
I loved agree. Him. I think the word honest comes to mind the way that you're talking about it, because it never, there's no winking at the camera at all. And even down to like, sometimes they would show Barry looking at texts from NoHo Hank. And sometimes I remember he had a Bitmoji of himself. There was a NoHo Hank Bitmoji. And then like, he would use tons of emoji and stuff other times. And something about like when they were waiting for a bullet to arrive, and he said, and he sent like a GIF of a, a cat hanging. I said, hang in there, buddy. Like, all that stuff just feels so consistent with him.
Yeah. Really, really well written and extremely well performed.
The performances are serious, even though the things that they are given to do are silly. But I think from a like grand irony perspective, which we'll absolutely be talking about for the end of season four, I feel like both Bill Hader and Anthony Carrigan are given these cosmically absurd things to deal with. And when they respond in deadpan as themselves, it feels that much funnier that their reaction to things are, oh, wow. Oh, my God. Okay, I guess. And then the scene continues. And that's part of why I love the fact that Bill Hader is also the creator of the show, is that he's kind of putting himself through comedy boot camp to make this show and give himself some of the most absurd things. Anthony Carrigan's up there, too, where he's put in situations where, you know, he has to run screaming out of room because a firefight broke out or something.
Right.
I just love the meta of the fact that these two characters are given silly things to do cosmically.
I love that. And there's one character we didn't mention as we were doing some of these best ofs, which was Sally Reed, played by Sarah Goldberg, who I think, I'm going to go with unfairly. I think unfairly has a little bit of the same unfairness that the character of Skyler, I can't think of the actress's name, had on Breaking Bad. Anna Gunn, where the character feels unlikable, despite the fact that a lot of times they're making the right call. Sometimes they're not, right? That gets truer and truer for Sally Reed. But like, Sally is like a kind of a built-in foil, despite being Barry's significant other for much of the series. And I think, again, a really difficult role to pull off and a difficult character to commit to, and a really unlikable character in many ways, right? Like, she does not handle fame well.
No.
She's even when we think, hey, maybe she's getting a little bit better, when she's, you know, she's taking her lumps and she's being the acting coach and then just tries to snipe that woman's job. A true character study. But man, I really thought that Sarah Goldberg did a fabulous job with an almost thankless role.
Her journey from someone who starts off in this class, not naive, but like very dedicated to her craft, to the point where she starts working and achieves her dreams, but it doesn't pan out for her ultimately. And then I'd argue in season four, she's given the ultimate acting gig. Her journey of realizing who she is through all of that in comparison to all the characters that she plays and the producers of those things, Barry being one of them at one point, I think that she did an incredible job with a role that could be difficult, but she sells it and makes it hers.
Yeah, she starts out feeling like maybe a little tropey in that she's supposed to see the best in Barry and try to be a shining light, like the one good thing, I guess, that he should be moving towards in the beginning of the show. She gets a lot more complicated, a lot more interesting, but the interesting stuff that she has to do ultimately makes her kind of challenging to watch just because of all the stuff she's going through and how she's having to deal with it.
Yeah.
I think about that moment in season two where she rants at Barry in this one unbroken shot about the fact that she's a better actor than him, but he's the one that got a director audition immediately because he was tall. And that moment is so ugly for any character on television, but she leans so far into it and gives it so much oomph that I think it almost is, it's like so bad it's good, loops back around to, oh my God, this is stereotype breaking in how deep she is in this role and the fact that she's just saying it to Bill Hader, who does not react in that one scene in season two, which I thought was funny.
Yeah. And it's the word that I think of with much of her performance, and I know that scene, is like earnest. Like, she's not just saying it, she hasn't met, like, this is her life and she really feels it. She feels every word that she is hurling at him. And it's a lot. I appreciated about Barry as a series, not just this willingness or even eagerness to subvert expectations and to mess with traditional TV tropes, but like some pretty massive time jumps from time to time, particularly in the final season, where, you know, enough where you don't even know where you are. Like when we first flash to Barry and family now living off the grid or mostly off the grid. At first you have to wonder, is this a fantasy? Is this really happening? Because it's so jarring and so totally different from everything that's come before. And there are some shows that you would not trust with pulling you along for that ride. But I really feel like they nailed it over and over again of staying very true to their world.
There's kind of this bit on the Flophouse where a famous movie they covered, Bratz movie, has very early on in the movie a 2 years later title card that just brings down the house every time it comes on in a like good, bad movie watch night. And the fact that Barry pulled it off without being silly and, speaking of questioning reality, letting you decide, is this real? Is this not? For an episode and a half, I did not realize it was actually real. I was kind of half watching and I was like, okay, great. This is interesting. We're learning a lot about his character. Let's get back to present day so that we can follow. Oh, we're staying here for four episodes. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, God. I need to rewatch that episode and then move forward from there knowing it's real.
It's weird they play with us that way. I don't know. I did the same thing, Brian, where we get about halfway through that episode and I'm like, are they like sticking with this? Is this really happening? And they cleverly enough, they've done enough of these dreamlike sequences and it really did feel dreamlike, where you're just kind of, snapping to grid, I guess, assuming that that's what it's going to be. But, wow, it, I didn't even know what to expect after that. I guess that's the idea, right?
Yeah. And I, there are many memorable moments to me from across the series. I have some recency bias where it's season four that is unsurprisingly painted most vividly in my head.
Yes. Same.
But I can't stop thinking about, I double checked episode six of season four, when that home invasion happens, when Barry's not there and there's the creepy body suited man following Sally around, never makes any physical contact with her. And then, like I said, seems to have a battle with somebody else while she's got her door closed, while her kid is, I think, drunk and passed out.
Yeah.
Because she's given him some alcohol, and then
the juice.
A car hits the house, and like, I still, you know, the series is over. I believe I understand kind of the journey that we went on. I don't know what happened in that episode. I don't know what part of it is real, and I don't. And listen, you can get into the Lost fan mindset or a certain kind of Lost fan mindset where you're like, I need answers to every single question. And I would love to know what the creators intended in that moment and in Sally's other hallucinations that we could tell were hallucinations, I think. But like, it's okay that I don't know. And I think that, listen, I would object in school when I was growing up to teachers who were like, let's find forced symbolism in some of these books. Sometimes it's there. Sometimes you know it's there and the author knows it's there. But like, when we're just cramming ideas in there, that's annoying. But here, I think that Barry is intentionally ambiguous sometimes in a way that is speaking to, if nothing else, this is an awful situation. There's a lot of unease here. Nobody is comfortable. Nobody feels safe. Like, that's that's hitting you over the head. But man, what do you think happened in that home invasion? Did the home invasion happen? I just want to know, Brian.
I read that as straight. Like, I figured that was genuinely what was happening. That was the guy at the restaurant that she like took into the bathroom. And he came in the morph suit. He locked her in the bedroom. And I imagined him saying, oh my God, what'd you do to me? You got something in my eye. What is that, metal? I read that as like, this is the story I will be telling about how you attacked me, but you are locked away and I'm going to trash your place. And I'm going to spread this story about you hurting me and attacking me when I came to visit your house innocuously. And then someone else in his little posse or whatever drove the car into the house. That I read that as not supernatural or a vision or anything. I thought that was him kind of implying he was going to gaslight everybody into believing this BS narrative he came up with.
You know, I agree. I think it was that that slime ball from the diner who was being super creepy there too. We'd seen enough of him being just kind of weird and creepy to did the house move? I don't know. That it feels like there might be some kind of I don't know, amplifying of it, maybe perhaps due to Sally's. I mean, she was drinking quite a lot at that point, so perhaps it didn't happen. But I did agree that there was. I assume that most of what was happening that we saw did actually happen.
So I would tend to Google after some of these episodes to be like, what did I just see? And it was on Collider, an article that the listener can find if you Google for it, where they made the arguments for why it could be real or why it could have been a hallucination. Like the whoever the intruder is uses an identical line that, as they term it, the motocross goon used when he attacked Sally back in season three. So like there were intentional explicit references to prior moments, which again could be coincidence or could not be.
Mm.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Brian Hamilton, you earlier referenced the kind of, I forget the beautiful term you used, but the irony, particularly in season four. I want you to plumb that deeper for us.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. Jumping right ahead to that final shot of, were those the kids from Stranger Things, by the way?
Oh, yeah, it looked like it. I don't think so. Was it?
I wonder. I'll Google that when someone else is talking. But that final shot where they're watching this movie, and at the end, we see that Gene Cousineau is in jail for life and Barry Berkman is buried at Arlington National Cemetery with honors, is the funniest freaking thing to me in the entire show after everything we've been through, after seeing characters wrestle with the most difficult moral decisions anyone has had to deal with on TV, even more difficult than Breaking Bad, because I don't think very often he had decisions Walt had to make. He just kind of kept the path the entire time, whereas we see Bill Hader make a lot of decisions. We see Henry Winkler have to make a lot of really difficult decisions, and most of the time they're revealed to be cowards, and a few times they show some backbone. And all of that leading to that one title card in that crappy movie that those kids just watched, that's the funniest thing to me about this entire series after we saw these characters go through the worst emotions they have ever seen. And that it feels sadistic for me to say that, but I just think it's so funny how it is structured in that way.
What I appreciated, where some of what I thought you might have been alluding to when you referenced that irony, is Cousineau's fatal flaw. Like, Cousineau definitely tries to become a better person over time. And who's the actor who they say is going to come out of retirement?
Daniel Day-Lewis,
right? Like, hearing that,
his tone the entire time.
Right. Like, that's what lures him in and lures him into a investigator trap, I guess. But I appreciate that. Part of, to me, the semi-depressing message of Barry is that people don't really change, right? Like, I really not struggled with, like, I didn't believe the narrative device, but I really, I was not at all in the mood to forgive Barry even as he found religion, right? Especially when he was doing podcast shopping until he could find somebody giving him the advice that he was allowed to call people.
That was the fucking...
There's so much, like, in Judaism, we talk about rabbi shopping, right? Like, if you don't get, like, hey, am I allowed to eat this thing? Or can I do this one thing I want to do on the Sabbath, even though that's, and, like, you keep asking rabbis until you get the answer you want. And Barry was doing that with podcast. Like, he's not good. And he wants to be good, but still isn't good. And even though he can defend all the things he wants to do, he's a bad guy. And then in the end, he is seen as a hero, not just by the world, but by his son, which I know would really matter to him. But he never really changed, even if the fiction version of his life has him as a hero. And Gene Cousineau wanted to get better and wanted to be seen as better by his son, and instead is seen as guilty of murder and serving that life. Like, it's what I appreciated was that so much of TV is about escapism or finding some version of a happy ending, or, you know, people changing over time. And I appreciated, to me, the irony of this story is, no, they didn't change. Their lives changed and things happened to them, but they were the same people and suffered for it in their own ways.
Hey, what's up, Christ fam? Pastor Brian here telling you it's not a sin to kill someone.
One of the heartbreaking things about Barry as a character is that he genuinely does try to get out of this whole shooting other people situation in the first season or so. And I think that's why I rooted for him early on, because I was like, yes, I think he can do it. And of course, in the back of my mind, I'm like, I'm watching TV. I don't think it's going to go this way. but I still wanted it to work out for him. And there's a naivety to Barry that goes all the way through to season four that he does kind of believe that this is the one last thing I need to do to get out. And that's the heartbreaking thing, that like we see it before he does, that it's really never going to happen for him. And for everybody who watches it, maybe it happens at different seasons or different times during the season. Perhaps someone from season one is like, well, you know, this is a show about a hitman and he's just going to keep shooting people. But I think there's like a hopefulness that does die out eventually for everybody. Maybe that's ironic. I don't know, but it is.
I think it counts. There's also absolutely, like Barry's last line, I guess, is oh, wow, right before Cousineau shoots him. And I feel like that line means a lot, too. Like even at the very end, Barry is surprised to realize that Cousineau doesn't love him, that Cousineau, in fact, hates him with a murderous rage, that Cousineau wants him dead, and that he doesn't think that Barry was okay or defensible or forgivable. Like that, oh, wow, to me is Barry being like, oh, really? Like I'm this didn't work. And he never, I guess maybe in that final second, he learned the lesson, but the fact that he is so surprised by it is quite a thing.
Going back briefly to Cousineau's cop trap, when he wanted to meet with Mark Wahlberg, I didn't quite grok this, and I would love to get your take on this. Why did the $250,000 that Barry gave Cousineau make the cops think that Cousineau was the brains behind the operation? I watched that scene a few times, and I don't quite think I absorbed it.
Brian Warren, do you want to answer
I'm
that
thinking.
One? I'll take the third part last.
At the very least, I'll be very happy to know that other people are confused by this, too.
I shared the confusion. As I watched it, I didn't watch it multiple times, but as I watched it, I did share that confusion. Like, I don't understand how these pieces get them to this confusion, or to this conclusion rather. I don't have an answer for you.
I suppose if cops are snooping around and they find an unaccounted for $250,000, that will make them start to want to connect dots and assume, I suppose, that that's a part of it. Now, does that make Cousineau the brains of the operation to get paid a whole bunch of money? I don't know. But
it at least shows that they are, I guess, if nothing else, you could assume that there was cahoots, right? And that's mm-hmm. the takeaway, right? Money was changing hands. So they were conspiring together.
The other thing is that so many cops in this show are just bumbling idiots. And I think it's very refreshing to see the way that cops are portrayed in this world that Barry's created as not the like protectors or the, you know, people who are actually, you know, doing anything worthwhile. They are people who are kind of screwing up the investigation. They raid a Dave and Buster's at one point. That was very funny. I just love that it's their ineptitude that lets Barry get away with so much stuff the entire run. And that kind of leads to that final ending shot of the fake movie within the show of Barry's great and Cousineau is serving life in prison.
In that final episode, there's a massive shootout where it starts with Fuchs shooting NoHo Hank. And that scene I watched multiple times, and I'm definitely not a violence guy. Like I often squint and look away at things. I get grossed out by them, but the direction and frankly, just the success in putting it on film or camera, whatever you want to call it, of that shootout is remarkable, because after Fuchs shoots Hank, we get one shot of this massive gun battle. And I honestly don't know how they pulled it off. Maybe there's behind the scenes clip somewhere, but there's tons of shooting. There's like body parts flying, I guess.
And
there's
body parts
and whatever.
There's some legs, there's some intestines.
And then we watch the camera like slowly pan through it. And Fuchs, of all people, gets a redemptive moment where he helps Barry's son out of the, mm-hmm. the chaos and covers his eyes. And is very fatherly towards him and very, I would say, loving towards him in the same way that he at times clearly felt towards Barry himself. But it's that scene is remarkable. And I finished watching it. And I'm like, wait a second. Was that all one take? And it was all one take. And I was like, how? And I still don't know how. But it is remarkable. It is a feat of something. I don't know why it had to be that way, but it certainly worked. And it's one of those I appreciate. I didn't know how Barry was going to end. I appreciate when a show can surprise you, but not give you any time to catch your breath, right? Like, no spoilers for Breaking Bad, but main characters sometimes die in Breaking Bad, and you don't know when that's going to happen. Then when it happens, they don't like necessarily dwell on it poetically. It just keeps going. And here you have this beloved character, NoHo Hank, get dead, and like you knew it was a possibility, but you know it was going to happen. And like, there's no time because now there's this massive shootout. And now we've got the sun coming out. And now we're like, Barry's sun, that is, not the one in the sky. And then it just, but like, there's no time to catch your breath or to sit with it or to, there's no time to mourn basically because things keep happening. Story keeps happening. And I think there's something pretty remarkable about having the confidence to tell a story in that way.
Two things about that final scene. One is that another Breaking Bad parallel, I guess, is the Breaking Bad podcast. I love the final season of Breaking Bad. I think it's one of the best things that's ever aired on television. My one criticism with the finale of Breaking Bad is that I don't think the final villains he deals with are as interesting or compelling or big or evil as some of the previous villains he had dealt with in seasons prior. I kind of feel that way about the finale shootout of Barry structurally, where we've had a lot of violence throughout the series. We've had a lot of big shootouts. We've had a lot of big, incredible production moments like that. And that final shootout was a very, very good shootout. But I think the show is very wise in not hanging a lantern and structuring the entire episode around the shootout. That whole thing must have taken, 5-6 minutes? And then the rest of the episode happens around it. I thought it was very smart to give the final episode a massive shootout, but it's not like the one we've been waiting for the entire show because both groups have been fighting the entire time. And it's not something that makes or breaks that final episode. It makes me feel like they knew they wanted to include it and then gave it all the production value it is warranted and then go away and move on to rest of the things. And I agree with you, Lex, that, dear God, that one take of all the, I imagine, practical effects of, like, you know, body parts and limbs and things while Fuchs is doing this really incredible fatherly thing, really, really great moment. But the other thing about that moment in particular is that I think Barry overall has done the best job of warranting HBO's, like, TVMA rating for comedic effect and for kind of like gross out silliness factor while also being very, very impactful emotionally to watch. All the blood and guts in that one shot, all of the gore that happens early in the show in season one. When Barry bends over in season, I believe, 2, when he like rips out the stitches in his back, that was disgusting. Oh, and yeah. The best use of kind of the elevated R-rated things that HBO lets people get away with, I think Barry uses that to the best effect of anything I've ever seen. Looking at you, Game of Thrones.
I think Succession does it well for language. But I'm Brian Warren, I'm curious for your take on all the things that Brian Hamilton just said. But I want to very quickly not let you do that and interject to say these three things in response to Brian Hamilton. Because Brian, first of all, that scene that feels so long. That shootout, it's fewer than 2 minutes, which is amazing to me. But I guess where I would challenge you, or where I at least disagree with you, is I think that in Breaking Bad, we've definitely seen more, because this is a Breaking Bad podcast, and honestly, the creative team behind Barry made reference quite often to taking some influence from Breaking Bad. But I think that the final season villains were not as menacing as prior seasons, but they were quite possibly the most evil. they were quite possibly the most truly evil, where they had no loyalty really to anybody. And I felt like you're right that having this shootout not be the centerpiece, but still be a violent work of art, try to pay tribute to, hey, these were incredible characters who you loved. And yeah, they went out in a blaze of glory. And that's not the focus of our story. Like, it is a part of our story, but it's not the center of our story. Something about it felt very, not fan service exactly, but it was like, we know you care about these people and we know this will be a difficult moment, but it's not even the focus of this. And there's something, I felt like my hand was being held through it. I felt like Fuchs was guiding me through the
mess. He's covering
Fuchs
your
is everyone's
legs.
Dad.
That's right. Episode title. Brian Warren, though, your thoughts on all this?
Yeah, I think some of my favorite scenes from the whole, or some of my favorite like action-y kind of scenes from the whole series did kind of feel, for one, they're really, really well shot. And then also they kind of felt like they played out in real time. And I think that's what, of course, doing a single cut scene like this where it's a big shootout, that's how 2 minutes can start to feel like 5 minutes. Yeah. And it's kind of, it feels very intense for that reason. There are like slower, quieter moments during it, which is just kind of maybe a little more creepy, but really, really cool. Some of the other ones that I really liked were the fight scene that Barry has with the creature daughter, Lily. That whole season, that whole scene right before it, he's fighting the Taekwondo master guy, Ronnie, who he ends up, there's even like parts of the action that just happen off. The camera doesn't stop shooting, but they'll like have a little fight in a closet and then they'll go around and then he'll like punch him in the trachea or something. And then finally it ends with him like doing a bunch of nunchuck stuff. But it does feel almost slow in that there's not a lot of cuts and the stuff is happening in real time. The other one that comes to mind is in season, I think it's season three or season four. No, I think it was season three, where there's this big chase scene that Barry starts in a car, but ends up on a like a dirt bike kind of thing. And he's being chased like by these other dirt bike assassins. And then they even end up on the highway for a while. And then they go and they end up, there's like a little bit of a shootout at a dealership at the end. That scene also, there were plenty of cuts in it and stuff, but it felt like it, again, played out in real time. And there were like quiet moments in between. They didn't have a ton of, you know, the Bourne supremacy fast cuts, and there's rarely like a ton of like majestic music playing at the same time either. And so all that stuff feels really intentional, and it gives some of these scenes a little bit of breathing room, but it's really masterful all the while.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
I promise I'm going somewhere with this. One of my favorite things about American Idol, MasterChef, Survivor, Hell's Kitchen, those kinds of shows are that there is a distinct difference between the beginning and end of a series where, you know, at the beginning, it's 20 chefs all, you know, chopping onions or whatever. And the finale is three chefs. You've seen their journey. There's the final three at Survivor and they do the big final tribal council and things like that. I feel like Barry as an entire series had that not exact same arc, but a similar kind of, we start in this acting class with Henry Winkler mentoring Barry and end with dark, far future kind of cosmic irony, horror stuff. It felt like, you know, for Breaking Bad, it felt like each season, while, you know, a self-contained story for the most part, the seasons in Breaking Bad kind of felt more like production necessities, where like we need to budget and write for this season, then this season, then this season. Overall, you can kind of marathon all of Breaking Bad and it feels like one continuous story, which is great, which is great. There's nothing wrong with that. Every season of Barry is so distinctly different that I was so kept on my toes the entire time structurally, not just with the characters, what they're doing, not just with the plot, but with where the hell is this going to go now that there's an 8-year time jump? What the heck is going to happen now that Henry Winkler knows what Barry did to his girlfriend, and how is that going to affect everything? If every season of Breaking Bad is like a separate novel, the first season of Barry feels like a comic book, then the second season's a novel, and the third season's a webcomic, and the fourth season's a something. Like, it feels so different to the point where bringing it all together as a single series product that we can stream on Max, it feels so special, and so I cherish this show. It's a gem.
And I thought, Brian Hamilton, that earlier you made the interesting point about who do you recommend this show for? And I even wonder that sometimes with Breaking Bad. When I started Breaking Bad, I watched the first episode after people were raving about the show. I was like, this is not for me. And it took me a couple of years to go back to, and then I really love the show. I'm on my third watch through now with my eldest, and we're going to actually probably finish it this week as we record. But this is a challenging show that only gets more challenging. And like, even if you like season one, you might not. I certainly have friends who dropped off because it got too much for them, or too weird for them, or too something for them. And when you talk about as I said, I think that Barry is a character that you're not supposed to root for. I think Sally is like, as we were talking today, I was thinking, why did Sally choose to go with Barry? And I don't know that I can verbalize the right answer. Like, mm-hmm. she's, even Barry is surprised. She's like, yeah, let's go. Like, it's, I don't know if I can explain what motivates her to make that decision.
And I've, like, got a theory, but we'll wait till after you said
it. I want to hear it. But when I think about how, like, oh, I love NoHo Hank. No, Hank's a bad dude. Like, I shouldn't love him either. He's also really bad. And so, like, it is, I don't mind watching bad characters. I love the movie Goodfellas, right? Like, you can enjoy the theatricality of these things. I think that why Barry works, I think that Barry only worked for me because of the journey it went on. Meaning, because it started as comedy and then moved to use comedy to make it more palatable and also lived in this surreal place. Like, I never felt gross watching it, right? Like, I didn't like some of these characters. I didn't like most of these characters, but I felt like neither did the show, if that makes sense. Not that the show didn't, you know, the actors clearly are not phoning in these performances like we've talked about prior, but the show doesn't want us to root for these characters, really. The show is well aware that these are highly flawed people in a highly flawed alternate version of reality, I guess. And I do struggle with who, if you haven't watched this, I mean, if you haven't watched the show and listened to this podcast, I don't know what you're doing, but if you did enjoy the series, like, who do you tell to watch it? And that's, I don't know how to answer that one. But Brian, you had some thoughts on why Sally goes with Barry.
She feels insurmountable guilt about the motocross thug that she killed, that she thinks she's going to get in horrible, horrible trouble if she does not have Barry's protection. When the news breaks about Barry being put in jail at the beginning of season 4, she's like, I wasn't there. I don't know what you're talking about. Wait, what? Sally, what are you talking about? No, I was not there. I don't know what you're talking about. She's covering her tracks. Mm. And she still feels that guilt throughout the entirety of the first half of season 4, where if she stays in LA mentoring this very charismatic actor, she is scared she's going to go to prison. And I think that is why they go together.
Yeah, I believe it.
I do have a question for you, Lex. You spent time in LA, correct?
I did.
I have not spent any time whatsoever in LA. So, but this show feels like something that really does infuse a lot of, like, LA DNA and a lot of, maybe not inside jokes, but local bits in it. Is that something that you got as you watched the show? Does this feel like a very LA show?
It did feel very much of its place in LA for me. I don't recall offhand, like, inside LA joke moments, but it did feel very much like it wasn't LA standing in, but it nailed the vibe of LA. Although I think sometimes they had a little bit of fun with how quickly they could get from place to place within Los Angeles. Because that's why I left LA, because you couldn't get anywhere ever. Listen, there are cliches and stereotypes surrounding aspiring Hollywood actors. And this show employs those, I think. But does it in a way that, again, felt to me very grounded. Because I lived in LA for 4.5 years. And we left LA for 3 main reasons. We couldn't afford a house there. We were really tired of how it took forever to drive places. And at least in the crowd we were in our very early 20s, it felt like everybody wanted to know who you were connected to and how your status could help theirs, or if it could. And I know these people. Like, I don't know the murderers necessarily, but I know these actors. And, like, that moment in season 4, I guess, where Sally's got the acting student and is showing, here's how she should deliver this monologue and what it should look like. And, like, takes her focus, like, literally is, I think the staging of it is she steps in front of the actress who's, like, way taller than she is and has the role, and just, like, everything, like, she is absolutely willing to throw that student under the bus and get the part, and everyone knows it, and they're all just, like, moving on, like, nope, we're gonna stick with her, and thanks, that was great. But, like, it's that part of it felt non-parodied, I guess is the way I'd say it. Like, the students in Henry Winkler's classes and these people and personalities felt, the only time it ever felt like exaggerated to me was how quickly Sally became absolutely insufferable when she was briefly very successful.
Wow. That is a really good read.
There were a couple parts that felt parody to me, but this is a completely uneducated side of things, because I've never tried to go pitch a show to a studio yet. You know, we'll see. But there's that point where they're pitching to bring Sally on to like run the writer room for this show, The Three Medusas or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the studio person's like, well, you know, it right now it's more, but we need Sally to bring a yeah to it. And then there's a hey, and then, you know, and they keep going back and forth and they're talking this ridiculous lingo. But I don't know. Maybe people do talk like that in Hollywood. You tell me, Lex, but I'm curious.
I recall at the time seeing something, because I really did browse the web after every one of these episodes, but seeing something that was like, that scene feels like an SNL sketch and it doesn't belong here. But it didn't, I do think that it was, you know, exaggerated for comedic effect, but it didn't feel beyond the realm of believability. There are so many, like, listen, I most of my entertainment career was podcast focused, but I was absolutely in meetings where you would hear dialogue that would fit in that conversation. Let's say you'd hear genuine conversation with people talking about dumb stuff in dumb ways, thinking that they were brilliant creative minds. So I think it was exaggerated, which I think you could also call parodied, but it still felt reality based to me.
It did have while it didn't feel like that scene could have ever happened that way, it did feel like it was grounded in things that probably did happen. People did say, someone probably was in a meeting that they wanted to exaggerate and put on a script like this. It was pretty funny.
In that same vein is that scene about, well, the algorithm decided you're not really in our best interest. So funny to, because that was, I think, season 3, right? And I watched this all in the midst of the Max debacle. So it was very funny to have that scene right smack dab in the middle of me having to sign into a new freaking app on my iPad.
With entirely new recommendations, too. It's pretty funny. I remember when I launched the new Max app, I was like, where did all these shows come from? But yeah, that's neither here nor there.
And I guess to this point, if you haven't yet watched Barry and want to, do it quick before Max, you know, unceremoniously deletes it for some reason. Are there shows that you feel like, hey, if you liked Barry, you'll also like, obviously we've made multiple allusions to Vince Gilligan shows, but are there other things that you think of like, hey, this, I liked this in the same way that I like this other thing? I'm really just trawling for recommendations.
Yeah, if you could give me some of those recommendations too, I'd really love that.
So this is really an exercise for the listener and or Brian Warren. So Brian, we all look to you.
We welcome your input, listeners, because it did feel, there were some elements of this that felt like there were things I had not ever seen before. Like, I can't remember why they're in some Chechen's garage. They're having this sit down with a mobster or something, and he says something like, "We need to be quiet. My daughter's having a sleepover tonight, and we're being too loud." And that sounds dumb when I say it. When we saw it on the screen, I laughed so hard. I was like, "What show am I watching? I've never seen anything like this before." That wouldn't have happened in Breaking Bad. Maybe in Better Call Saul, but I don't know.
The two that I think of, neither of which I can full-throatedly recommend, but that I enjoyed much of, Dexter, not the same show by any stretch, a lot more procedural, but had some vibe overlap, especially bad guy who thinks he's maybe not the bad guy. And then, did either of you watch Patriot on Prime Video?
Oh, the first season, not the second. Very great show.
That's a show that I feel like has a lot in common with Barry in certain ways, just from a little bit genre bending and bizarre and dark, but comedic. So that's the best I can do.
You know what? Breakfast Bread's a whole spread. That whole repeated bit feels like it could have come out of Barry. I love that. The other thing that I guess talking about this now kind of strikes me as somewhat relevant is I Think You Should Leave on Netflix has the same kind of what the hell kind of world is Tim Robinson building here where any of this makes sense. We as the audience get to laugh at it, but everyone in the world of the show is kind of rolling with it or kind of buying into whatever bit is being given. And I think Barry has some sense of that. We've been talking a whole bunch about things like, you know, deadpan things that are given to us as something that if we, you know, say it ourselves is not very funny, but seeing it in the context of the show with the impeccable creative funny timing of Bill Hader's direction and all the other performances that were happening, there's so many gems in this show that actually feel a little bit out of I Think You Should Leave. I think my favorite one, because I just rewatched this episode and it stuck with me even when I first saw it, was by law, I'm required to show you these photographs in the jump forward. And so many things were encapsulated in that one bit where in 8 years, it is easy enough to get guns in a Walmart in California. And the best that the lobbyists could do is cigarette style. This is what cigarettes will do to your lungs, to bullet holes given to you at Walmart. I just thought it was so dark and so funny. And I had to pause to unpack that for a full 2 minutes before I could move forward.
That was rough. That was dark.
Just honestly, Barry's treatment of Walmart and your ability to buy guns there and stuff as built in, all of it felt very dark. Like I didn't feel like it was the show making a political statement exactly, but I thought it was leaning into the darkness of its reality. Like, because you can in many places go into Walmart and buy these guns and be grumpy and nobody says a thing. It's a scary show.
Very scary show. The other bits in the far future that got me were Larry Chowderman, Magical Boy or whatever it was on the animated billboard next to Mega Girl 4. I also loved the mention of phone movie. Like we can't make a theater movie, but we can probably make a phone movie.
Yes.
I imagine in 8 years in Bill Hader's dystopian future, like, it's not even like streaming versus theatrical release. It's like you watch it on a phone, you watch it on an iPad, you watch it in your HoloLens, or you watch it in your in a movie theater. That also tickled me.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a show that's short, right? Like this is even short, I think, in streaming series, right? Each season was 8 episodes. And a lot of these
streaming
series,
they're 30-minute episodes too.
That's right. A lot of them will do 13 or thereabouts. And this was tight. And I really felt like the single biggest benefit was it never felt like there was filler, including like with lines of dialogue. It really felt like when I rewound scenes to watch again, it never felt like there was puffery. It really felt very tightly crafted. And I love that. Like, it just felt like it honored my time and that they clearly worked hard on the crafting of it. And obviously every TV show has tons of time and effort put into creating it and scripting and all those things. Like, I get that, but this one, it really felt like they sweat the right stuff. And that it showed that it worked on the screen because of the amount of time they spent crafting things. And I, like I said, I think that when you, in quotes, only have to do 8 episodes, like that's a help. And they really, this is a fascinating show. And I really looked forward to it. And the final season was running simultaneously to Succession's final season. I like that show a lot. And they both air, I guess, back to back on Sundays, right? And so then I never watched them live, but I would watch them streaming and would really struggle with which one to watch first. And I think, Brian Hamilton, you were kind of making the point of it's such a heavy cliffhanger show, and you want to know, how will this happen? Like, what will come of these things? So I would always go to Barry first, which I would say surprised me every week. But I knew I have to know what happens there first. Even though everybody's going to be talking about Succession, I need to know what's going to happen to Barry. Is Barry going to be okay? I hope not. That was kind of the logic.
How'd y'all avoid spoilers while watching?
Oh, good question. I don't talk to other people in my regular day-to-day, so that... And, like, of the people I text with regularly, I imagine, like... Lex is the other Barry fan, and so he and I are pretty good about not texting each other anything spoiler worthy.
Rage quitting Twitter certainly helped.
Good point.
And yeah, I mean, if I was much more prone to risking seeing Succession spoilers, because it was the kind of show where so many people did watch it in real time that folks thought it was safe grounds to post about socially. But much like Brian Warren, I just did not talk to a lot of people who were watching Barry. And if I saw any post that could even have a whiff of something, I would just mute that person for probably a week for my own safety. I haven't seen a single post online in about a month from all the meeting I do. No, but and here's the truth of it is, unless I'm at the very final episode where I've waited all that time, I don't hate spoilers the way so many people do. Because I really do think it's gotta be way more about the journey than I don't want to say the This Nation be too cliche, but like if it's just about what's the big reveal or what's the thing that's going to happen, like that shouldn't in my mind be what it's about. I want to see how the story's told. If I can enjoy the rewatch as much or more as the original thing, then clearly the spoilers didn't matter all that much, because like knowing what's going to happen, that only happens once. But if I find out from you or I find out from watching, it doesn't make a huge difference to me, unless, like I said, if it's the last episode's there and I'm going to watch it and then I see it 20 minutes before then, that's annoying. But otherwise, like if I knew about the Sixth Sense twist before I saw the movie, which did happen, thanks to a professor in college who spoiled it to it, the week it came out, spoiled it to a giant class of film studies. It didn't negate my ability to enjoy that movie. It just changed how I experienced that movie. That's my weird side rant on spoilers.
I watched Succession live most weeks, and if I was like a day or two behind, I wouldn't be spoiled, but I would see things on social media, and I am the like full media blackout, avoid all spoilers. My roommate, who I've also been watching Barry with, who they watched as it aired and I was kind of watching after them, they came downstairs the other day and sat down and said, hey, have you seen this other show? Well, let me tell you about it. Structural spoilers, but the first scene is present day and then the rest of it is a flashback. I was like, I've never felt more loved and held by you than when you said structural spoilers. You know me so well. And to that point, the fact that I didn't watch any of season four until maybe a week ago, that I was not spoiled on the time jump is something I will cherish for the rest of my life, that I had that experience of watching at like 2 a.m. the flash forward and realizing, no, this is where the show is actually going from here on in. It's magical moments like that that make me feel grateful that I don't watch trailers or spoilers or anything like that.
We didn't mention this too much, but as you were talking about that flash forward, those scenes, even though they were part of the reality of the show, still felt like such a different reality. And man, Barry Berkman, a terrible homeschool teacher, like not up to that job at all. And I was just remembering how mad I was at him trying to do a good thing with his son and how much I hated it.
What was that he said on the phone? Sally asks, what did you two learn today? And he comes back, oh, what did I teach him? Like, he's so full of himself.
Oh, the way he tried to like shelter him from weird stuff by just showing him the worst things in the world. That was awful. And then he was so excited about his like new book about Lincoln or something showing up. In a lot of ways, Barry is such a child in this show.
Yes.
The shooting other people, maybe not so much. But the... he pulls out a lot of really weird lines about being a little kid, and he just doesn't really get a lot of things that feel so natural to us just living a normal society, I suppose. But it was pretty funny. But we homeschool our children here, we do it a little bit differently than that, and so thankfully our kids are a little more well adjusted, I suppose.
How do they feel about baseballs?
Yeah, you know, we don't talk about it. It's okay.
I think Bill Hader already had this, but now it's even truer that he gets the green light for me. Like anything he makes, I'm going to want to watch.
Yeah. I'm curious when the two of you stopped rooting for him. Like for me, I was on Team Barry season one. And then it fell off pretty quick, realizing things were not going too well. Were you earlier on than me? Was I being too naive? Did you have more hope?
I was there with you. Season one, his anger and remorse for having to kill his veteran friend, it was like a terrible thing that he did. And I also felt for him, which is one of the reasons why I love shows like this and Breaking Bad, is even though we don't feel like empathy for the characters, we feel just enough of a sympathy that we can kind of experience emotions that we hopefully, dear God, knock on wood, hopefully don't experience in our day-to-day lives. And so season one, Barry, I was like rooting for him and hoping he could change. And then he kills Janice and I know, okay, he is irredeemable at this point. I am here to see him try to cover his tracks and try to keep his way in the world, to the point where I actually really reveled in and enjoyed watching him be on Murderer's Craigslist in the beginning of season three, because I was like, okay, if he's down on his luck and the worst thing is that he has to play Xbox between killing people, that's fine. Great. Good for you. Happy. Lex, what about you?
I'm still Team Barry. Is that not? No. I think I'm going to share your answer. It was probably the season finale of season one, you're like, nope, he clearly is never going to, he is irredeemable. And really, you should already know. I should have already known. But I realize that he's just beyond repair and impossible to root for by that finale of season one.
I'm going to stop rooting for Barry starting now. whose transformation in the back half of season four was your favorite? I'll start with Brian Warren.
Oh, I mean, watching Cousineau spiral was it was heartbreaking, but I'll say it was delightful in that I really liked how it was written, and especially that whole stuff with Daniel Day-Lewis. Like, you could see it coming before he could, I suppose, and that was kind of fun. And I'll go ahead and say Cousineau. How about you, Lex?
I'm going to go with John Bergman. Just kidding. I'm going to subvert the question, not to be rude, but because I think it's my honest answer, which is I appreciate that Hank stays so consistent, right? Like,
yes.
Hank is very true to who he is. And I think that's what I found remarkable, because like you're saying, there's so many arcs that people have, and Hank's arc is to me a straight line, which can't be an arc, but I appreciate that Hank is unwavering in his Hankness, despite everything, despite, you know, tragedy in his own personal life. He stays on a very direct path of, like, everything he does is tied directly to his Hankness.
His arc is less of a baseball and more of a bocce ball.
and what's your own answer to your question, Brian?
I think my favorite is Fuchs. The fact that we see a little bit of respect for him at the end of episode, four?
That's a great
of season
answer.
Four. That's when I start to put together, oh, I bet something's going to change for him. He's going to have a much better time in prison. I'm so grateful that we skipped ahead 8 years and got to see him be like this crappy, badass, biker, evil person. He's just as scummy as before. And we've seen him kind of chameleon and mask and code shift in different situations, talking to the Chechens, talking to the Bolivians, talking to Barry, talking to the cops. He's this scumbag, slithery. He reminds me of Littlefinger a lot from Game of Thrones. He's this like slimy, creepy dude. And the fact that we see him be exactly the same, but much more genuinely himself, I think that was my favorite. It wasn't even a redemption moment. It was just seeing him finally fully accept who he is and not have anxiety about it. Because someone only acts like that and chameleonifies themselves when they are people pleasers and when they're trying to alleviate their own anxiety about how they're being perceived by others. And the fact that, A, NoHo Hank gave him the Raven, which is a stunning bit of PR, and B, that he just kind of said, F it, I'll flip the table, I'll be whoever I want to be in prison. That gives him, in my opinion, my favorite transformation of the end of a season four.
There's you made reference to the baseball subplot of season four, where Barry's son John wants to play baseball, and so Barry subjects him, as Brian Warren is referencing, to watching videos of YouTube clips of kids getting severely injured or dead playing baseball. And something about that moment reminded me of the little loved Brendan Fraser, Alicia Silverstone star, Blast from the Past, which also featured Sissy Spacek and Christopher Walken. And Christopher Walken mistakenly believes that we're about to be destroyed by nuclear bombs, and so moves his family, including his young son, played by Brendan Fraser, into his bunker. And they live in that bunker for 20 years. And the son learns so much and is, you know, ill-prepared when he comes up on Earth and meets Eve, as played by Lisa Silverstone. Of course, Brendan Fraser is Adam. And they realize that life has gone on. But Christopher Walken is trying to explain baseball to his son, who's never seen it, and they don't have any videos or anything because of the era that the series is set, or the movie is set. And he's like, but why does he have to run to first? And like, why is he out? Like, what is it? And this his inability to understand this concept of this sport until he finally gets to see it live. There was something about that mini baseball subplot in Barry that kept making me think of that, even though it was told very differently. But this just Brendan Fraser's inability, youthful inability to understand why is he out? Why does he have to run there? And Christopher Walken's like, because he does. Like, man, there was a sweetness to it. This did not have that sweetness, but it still felt like the same muscle.
The fact that Bill Hader chose baseball to be the thing that he pushes back on his son for, you would expect that this character Barry has become is like all American apple pie kind of small town. We pull ourselves up by our bootstraps using Chechen blood money to survive in the middle of the wilderness. And the fact that his son, like his, the one thing he wants to do is play baseball, and that is too much for Barry to handle, is the perfect encapsulation of how, I don't want to say hypocritical, but how controlling he is of this little pod of his, especially because so much of his life has been out of control. They make mention to moving around a lot. I am so curious what their other lives were like before they wind up in this home in the middle of nowhere.
Well, I'm grateful to find both of you, Brian and Brian, as people who appreciated Barry. When Brian Warren and I talk about Sorkin movies, you know, some of them we like, some of them we don't like, some of them we love. There are a couple where we've said to each other that it's hard to really find a thing to pick on. It's hard to find a flaw. And I think that the biggest magic trick to me of Barry is that it's so strong in its own voice, in a voice that it doesn't have peers for, because of how, I'm trying to avoid using the word unique, but because of how unprecedented its voice and tone are, that it's hard to find a flaw with it, because anything that I can even point to and say, hey, this could have been done better, could have been handled better, probably couldn't, because it was all in support of the the strange tone and vibe of this show. So I'm not saying, hey, this is a perfect show, but also I can't really point to anything and say, boy, I bet they wish they could have that back. Like, there's no moment where it's like Friday Night Lights season 2, hey, let's have people kill somebody and then nothing ever happens from it when we abandon that plot line. Like, there's nothing where it's like, I bet they wish they could have that back. And that's remarkable.
Friday Night Lights never thought that anyone would rewatch the show, because it would depend on reruns in 2004 on ABC. So the fact that it's now streamable for everyone, it makes sense. I feel like Adam McKay, of all people, with you know, The Big Short and Succession and Don't Look Up, Adam McKay is like if Aaron Sorkin used to write for SNL and then had the career that he had.
Yeah, that's fair. Man. But I have thoroughly enjoyed getting to talk to both of you about this show, because I like thinking about Barry, because it really, it bends my brain in a way that I appreciate. I love TV. I'm not ashamed to admit it, Brian and Brian. I love television. I love great television.
Take that stand.
I will. And I proudly watch TV, but this series, like in a way that it occupies by itself, really bent my brain, where I could finish each episode and be like, not even like what just happened, but like, why just happened? Why did this happen? Why was this the half hour that I just got to see, in a way that I really, really enjoyed over and over again? And it surprised me a lot too. You couldn't predict where it was going because it was crazy.
Yeah, as in a similar feeling, when some of these episodes, when they just finished, I would just have this grin on my face, like, how did you just pull that off? That seems unfairly good. I don't have to agree with everything, that all the choices that they made, like in writing the plot or whatever, but I cannot fault their execution. And similar to you, like, I can't pick apart it and say it's not a good show. Like, there's too much going for it. And it did bend my brain in ways that I was thankful for.
More half-hour dramas, please.
Yeah.
So you're calling it a drama. Okay. So noted.
Okay. It's not a comedy in that it's not easy to watch 5 episodes of, like Parks and Rec, but it also doesn't require the 45-minute to an hour commitment of most of the other shows of this caliber. The only other like half hour drama I can think of is Homecoming on the Amazon Prime Video. I hope there are others. I would love to hear more.
What you've actually solidified for me, and I'm making this more of an aha moment than is fair, but we've got the word dramedy, and I think this show is the other version of that word that doesn't really exist without saying comma, right? Like it's a comedy drama more than it is a drama comedy to me. So wow. It's the same genes, Cousineau, but it's the other way around. It leads with comedy and ends with drama. Kamadama. Kamadama, chameleon, I think is the
I'll
official
call it
term.
Dark comedy. Dark comedy works for me. That kind of introduces that level of drama into it, and the maybe the irony that you were talking about before, Brian.
it's making me realize how much effed up stuff I laughed at during this show talking to y'all.
Well, thank you both, Brian and Brian. Brian Warren, any parting wisdom from you?
I'm just so thankful to chat with the two of you.
And Brian Hamilton?
Oh, wow. Barry's last words.
I thought Brian Hamilton
was a lot of fun.
I'm so grateful for the chance to talk with one of you. I'm not saying one. No. I couldn't ask for a better Brian or Brian. So thank you both. And thanks again to Jason Snell and to you, dear listeners of The Incomparable.